Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Genuinely Grace. I hope you've had a great week. It's been fantastic for us because we did our live podcast recording. You're going to get a chance to hear that fabulous interview very soon. So we were at Club Soda, the Club Soda Tasting Room in Drury Lane last Tuesday with a whole bunch of podcast listeners and Sober Club members. And it's just really great to meet in person. Honestly, those years and months when we were all stuck indoors and we couldn't meet anyone, honestly, torture, really. We just really so need connection, don't we? So it was just fantastic to get to meet lots of people, some I hadn't met before. Of course, there was a train strike, so lots of people couldn't make it, and I'm so sorry if that's you. We really missed you, but thank you so much to those who came, and it really was fantastic to be able to get to share the joys of sobriety and to have such a special guest as Catherine Gray. Most of you know that Catherine was a very big inspiration for me in my early months of sobriety, and she was one of my first podcast guests as well. Absolutely love her book. So we talk about all of that stuff in the podcast, of course. So you get to hear that very soon. But one thing I just wanted to mention was just another big thank you to Laura and the guys at Club Soda for hosting us in that venue, because it really adds another dimension that people can come into a space where there is an actual bar where you can, you know, take mates, meet them in London and take them for a proper grown-up drink that just happens to be alcohol-free and tastes fantastic. And they were serving alcohol-free mulled wine and some really fabulous alcohol-free cocktails. And I got to try a alcohol-free red wine that I'd never tasted before. They just got so much in there that you can taste and buy at the bar. But then, of course, a full off-license as well. So just every single drink you can think of. And if you're thinking, no, I don't do those, in inverted commas, replacement drinks, that's fine too, because there's every incredible tonic and shrubs and artisan botanicals and kombuchas. There's absolutely everything. So it really is a fantastic place to be. And while we were there, it really made me realize how the industry has grown, how the whole sobriety business world has grown in the last few years. Even since I got sober, which is almost 6 years ago, one of the very first things I did was I met Laura Willoughby, and I went to one of the mindful drinking festivals, and I was blown away then by the choice. But now it's exponentially grown. It really is incredible. So things are definitely changing. I saw someone wrote a post on one of the groups I'm part of, I think it might have even been Janet, so we're going to talk about in a minute, saying that the rise in people searching for phrases like sober curious and mindful drinking, that the percentage has grown massively. It's something like, you know, there's been something like a 90% growth in people searching for those terms, which is, you know, it's all good, isn't it? Really is all good. We need to just, the more awareness we can raise of choosing this path is just fantastic. And that leads me on beautifully to the fact that we have a last minute collaboration for the podcast, which is with the Sober Business Network. And it's actually perfect with everything that I've just been talking about and the rise in popularity of people kind of doing this kind of work. So the question we have for you is, are you a sober business owner? And I appreciate lots of you won't be, but there may well be people who are. And you're finding that networking is really tricky. So Janet Hadley, who I just mentioned, she's the founder of Choose Sunrise. And she was really fed up with wasting time at networking events that were just totally alcohol fueled. I mean, we've all been there, haven't we? And she wants to meet like-minded sober entrepreneurs that she could collaborate with, and couldn't find anything. So she set up her own. So she now runs the Sober Business Network alongside her core business, which is also really interesting. I've interviewed Janet on the podcast before. She helps employers to create an alcohol safe workplace. There'll be many of you listening who wish that your employers made life a little bit easier for you if you're choosing not to drink. So that's Janet's core business. But she has a background in commercial corporate roles within some of the UK's largest companies. She's also an accredited Sober Club coach. She trained with me in my very first cohort. And Janet says that's what sparked her entrepreneurial journey. So that's all good. And then the aim of this Sober Business Network that Janet runs now is to grow your business faster by being part of a community. So you can be connected with other business owners, share industry news. You can spark ideas for collaborations with other businesses, ones that complement yours, provide a platform for knowledge sharing. You can generate new leads to your business through their Find Sober Heroes directory, and you can be upskilled through their Business Accelerator program. And there are lots of exciting collaborations that spring up in the network, connecting brands together. Maybe they want a sober copywriter or a sober clothing brand to collaborate with an alcohol-free drinks brand. There are just so many possibilities. So the network offers monthly Zoom networking meetings and live meetups and WhatsApp and Facebook community groups. So it's a fantastic initiative, and this space can really just only grow and grow when you, as I say, when you see the incredible array of alcohol-free drinks at the Club Soda tasting room. That makes you realize, wow, this industry is growing. It's fantastic. So check out the directory, and you can join online at soberbusinessnetwork.co.uk. And Janet is offering a free 30-day trial if you use the code Janey30, that's in capitals, Janey30, Janey30. You can use that at the checkout. So it's soberbusinessnetwork.co.uk. So back to our live event then. It was just wonderful to see Catherine. I kind of got her out of retirement a little bit because I don't think she's done many speaking gigs for a while, because she now has a gorgeous baby, which we will mention in the interview. But she also has some really exciting stuff coming up in the future as well. So I really hope you enjoy the interview. And if you were at our event and you're hearing it all over again, maybe you get to hear yourself cheering in the background. Enjoy. Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, live from Club Soda. Yay! Look at that. And a huge, huge welcome to Catherine Gray.
Thank you. Thank you everyone for coming out. I'm so touched.
Isn't it amazing?
I'm so touched.
On a rainy night. So, Catherine, I it's really hard to know where to start because when I think back to my kind of early days, lots of people would have heard me say a lot of times that when I first stopped drinking, it was one of those things where I knew something had to change. You know, yeah. I just absolutely knew. I was not looking forward to it at all. But I just knew something had to give. And I had no idea how to go about it because I had no connections. I didn't know anybody. I had no idea that anybody else felt like me. I thought I was the only person who was... I knew I wasn't at rock bottom, but I knew I wasn't okay. And I didn't know anyone else like that, right? No. And then, as most people know, I was given Claire Pooley's book to read, which, and then, because then we were going to be interviewing her on Radio 2. And that was the thing that got me started. Like, okay, Claire can do it. I can do it. You know, so that was incredible. And everyone kind of heard me speak about that a lot. But I was still in that phase, if you like, for those few weeks of gritting my teeth and how long can I carry on for and what, and you know, so what do I have to do then, and when will the benefits kick in, and actually nothing did kick in particularly quickly. I couldn't sleep, I was grumpy as hell, I forgot everything I knew, which was interesting because I'd always been into being holistic and healthy living, but I actually forgot everything. So I you know, nothing was going right for me. I was really miserable. And then I came across your book, which totally reframed everything and put a complete spin on it.
Oh,
it was just so perfect. And all of a sudden I was able to kind of go, oh right, so this isn't a hardship and a sacrifice, and this isn't a shit thing to do. This is going to bring me joy. And you know, I don't think I'd ever even thought about that word other than being in church.
Yeah.
Or playing with someone's kid. right? Yeah. And suddenly there was this word, okay, so the unexpected joy.
Yeah.
And I mean, you must have had 1,000 people tell you it's the most inspired title.
Oh, well, I didn't come up with it. I wanted...
Oh, bloody hell, I'm cheated.
I didn't even write it. No, I didn't. I didn't. Yeah, I just got a ghostwriter to do it. No, I wanted to parody Marie Kondo. My original title was The Life-Changing Magic of Sobering Up.
Oh, okay.
The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. And my agent was like, no, Kath, you don't do that. Like, not in serious book world. You've got to come up with your own title. I was like, I don't know, I can't think of anything. I'll just riff off other people. No, and she came up with it. So congratulations, Rachel Mills.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, it really is a brand, isn't it? It's fantastic. Tell us a bit about your story then. For people who haven't, I know you were one of my very first podcast guests all those years ago. Like, gosh, I think you were number 3 or 4 or something. So that was amazing. And then I've interviewed you since for your other books, of course. But there will be people who haven't heard your story or they can't remember your story. So take us right back.
Okay, well, I would say that where I started running into trouble was when I was about 27. And I kept getting into hot water, as many people who have read the book will know. Literally, I once got into a hot tub at my work's Christmas party and took my top off. So that doesn't go down well with the boss.
And that's was that before or after photocopying your backside?
Do you know what? I never did that, but we didn't have a photocopier. That was the only reason. And I was just a bit of a joke. Like everyone, you know, I was the person that everyone wanted at the party, but also the person that people were laughing at by the end. And it looked fun on the surface. I was working at Glamour magazine. I had this. I could go to free drinks parties every night. Yeah. I could, you know, drink for free all the time, which I wanted to.
Yeah.
And so my lifestyle was very conducive to drinking. But I had this terrible darkness inside. I was so scared of what was going to happen. Mm. I was so scared that my boyfriend was going to find out about my many infidelities, which always happened when I was blackout drunk.
Right. Yeah, I remember you saying you used to have blackouts.
Yeah. I mean, often fragmented.
That's scary,
where
isn't
you, I mean, I'm sure many people in this room will relate, where you can, like, you have horrifying flashes and you're like, oh my God, that's a jigsaw puzzle I never want to put together. But then oftentimes just absolutely nothing. I would lose whole bars and clubs of nights out.
Wow.
And
so dangerous, isn't it, when you think about it? It's really scary.
I mean, I must have like stumbled into the road and things like that. I remember one time I was at a train station, I could barely walk. So it's quite amazing that serious harm didn't come to me. But I was very aware that I was on the precipice of that. So I started this moderate drinking experiment. And I started recording my units and, you know, reading everything I could about how to moderate. And doing things like going to the gym before I went to the pub, you know, having a glass of water. Everyone has tried these things. And none of it worked. You know, switching from wine to cider. Yeah, yeah. Didn't matter. I just drank more cider. So I always ended up drunk. And I didn't understand why. And nobody was talking about it. Nobody was saying, you know, Kath, maybe you've got an issue. People were sort of saying, maybe you don't need to drink 10 drinks, but they also weren't pegging me as having an addiction.
Yeah.
So I was living in that very sort of in-between land. And then from between the years of 27 and 33, when I eventually quit, it just got darker and darker and darker. And the scrapes got more and more scary. And it got to the point where I was actually quite scared to go out. Because I didn't know what was going to happen. That was when I had that episode at the train station.
Right.
And I was like, I could have fallen into the path of a train quite easily.
Yeah.
So I knew that not something needed to change, but the alternative, quitting drinking,
seemed terrible,
seemed like, you know, like social suicide. Because what happens when you are addicted to something as well, which I was 100% emotionally and physically addicted, your brain starts telling you that you need it for survival, like you need water or food or sleep or any of those things. So the thought of living without it is terrifying.
Yeah.
But also, I didn't know how I was going to have fun without alcohol.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's all we've ever known, isn't it? Every single bit of our, particularly if you start young, everything that you've gone through has been through that haze of booze. Your first partner, your first party, everything. Sex, everything has gone through the booze haze.
The filter.
So, like, how the hell do you deal without it?
I know. So I couldn't even imagine how I would date or dance or go to a Christmas party or any of these things without getting drunk and getting into a hot tub and taking my top off.
Yes. and were you did you share any of this with anyone, or was this all just going on in your own head? Did you have anyone who could kind of support you through any of it?
I remember I've never told the story. I told one boyfriend when I was about 31, and he'd found out about an infidelity and he was dumping me, and I remember him coming to see me and finishing with me, and I had gotten all of these bottles. I'd spent the weekend by myself drinking, and I got all these bottles up, and I lined them up, and I said, I think I have a problem. This is what I've drank this weekend. Can you help me? Because at that time I sort of thought that somebody else could give it to me. I was a love addict as well, I didn't realise that. But so I thought that maybe if he stayed with me, he could fix me. But obviously that never works. And he offered to pay for my therapy.
Right.
And I then went under, and it was a good year and a half, something like that, before I told anybody again. I think I thought that if I told anybody, it would set this chain of events in motion where I would have to quit drinking.
Mm.
And so I wanted to keep it to myself until I'd fully figured it out and fully explored the option of moderation, which clearly wasn't working.
Yeah.
One of my friends actually quite recently said to me, that was you trying to moderate. And I was like, yeah, could you not tell?
So what changed then? What was the you know, defining thing that made you eventually have your last day one?
Oh, that's such a hard question, because for me it was hundreds of things. Yeah. And I think a lot of people relate to this. It's not just like one big movie scene, like car crash, rock bottom. It's like an incremental build up where you're behaving in a way that you feel doesn't match your morals. And that was it for me. I didn't like who I'd become. So it was like, you know, in the last year or so of my drinking, I received a message from my best friend saying, when did you become such a bitch?
Nice.
There were so many things that happened that just brought me to the brink. And I was like, I couldn't foresee a future with drinking or without it.
Mm.
And I was researching suicide.
Wow.
Because I was in so much pain and I didn't know what to do. Mm. But then I wanted a painless suicide. And then I couldn't find one.
Wow.
So that was the point where I phoned my dad, who was, at the time, he was 21 years sober.
Oh, wow.
He's now passed. But I phoned my dad and I said, look, I really have an issue with drinking. And he said, I know. And he got on a plane.
Oh, bless him.
But it wasn't actually, that was in April 2013. And then there was like 5-6 months on of stopping, starting. The amount of time I was putting together was getting bigger and bigger, but the starting was worse and worse.
Yeah.
It just seemed like, because I'd named my addiction, it became more monstrous, and it grew teeth and claws and just was trying to almost take me down.
Right.
And so that was quite scary. But eventually it just stuck.
Mm.
And I think that's the best way to look at it. I mean, there's nobody, absolutely nobody, that gets it first time.
No, absolutely. It's around the block a lot, isn't it?
Yeah,
definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, I know a conversation that you and I have had before is that both of us came across Jack Trempe, who wrote about the addictive voice.
Yes.
It was a really old book. Goodness knows when.
1930s, I think.
Was it the 30s?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So, which I just found so fascinating. So he was a US
social worker, I think, and he came up with this concept of rational recovery, as he called it, didn't he? Where he, rather than taking the kind of standard AA 12-step approach, or there's something wrong with me, he was the first person, I think, that kind of introduced this idea of, do you know what? There isn't anything wrong with you. Mm. It's alcohol that is the issue. And actually, if you can start retrain your thoughts, actually notice the addictive voice, you can start to do something about it.
Yeah. And he was so ahead of his time.
Wasn't he ahead of his time?
What a thought leader.
Yeah.
Jack Trimpey.
Yeah.
I don't think it was the 30s. I think it might have been the 50s. Yeah. I think I've got that wrong.
I'm not sure. It's an old book. You can still get it, though.
Yeah. It's called Rational Recovery. Rational Recovery. It's a really good read. I read it about twice.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you, the thing that I took away from it was this addictive voice recognition technique.
Yeah.
And the idea is, because when that voice in your head is saying, like right now, mine's saying, I might have a cake when I get back to my hotel.
Yeah.
Gonna have a cake, gonna have a cake, gonna have a cake. Yeah. I actually do want a cake. But when it's a toxic addiction, it wants things that are not good for you.
Yeah.
It wants the worst for you. It's like your most toxic friend, you know, giving you really, really bad advice. So to other it and personify it and take it away, take that power away from it.
To be able to stand back and observe. It's that thing of, you are not your thoughts.
You
can stand back and observe. It was very real for me. I literally had that voice.
Yeah.
And the voice used to actually say to me, you know, well, there's a bit left in the bottle.
Yeah.
And then I would sort of answer it and say, I've had a shitload already, I don't need any more. The voice would say, well, it's there in the fridge. And you seriously.
You're just clearing up, you're just tidying up.
Honestly, it was literally like that. And then not long after that, I remember going to see a therapist. I mean, bless her heart, meant well and everything. But then she said, oh, I think maybe you've got an entity. Lord, give me strength. Like, I haven't got enough going on. Right?
That's funny.
Yeah, seriously.
Like a ghost.
How help? Yeah. they're called spirits for a reason, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
she absolutely might not have been that far wrong, but I was not in the place I was ready to hear that at that point. But you know, when I was able to, you know, finally grasp, okay, you're not your thoughts. If if that comes flying in, if that voice comes in, you step back and challenge it.
Yeah.
So, well, what the hell? No, actually, no, I won't be doing that.
Yeah. Did you give your voice a name?
No, I didn't actually. Some people do, don't they? Belle calls it Wolfie, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And some people call it the wine witch.
Oh, that's another place I got it from. Belle's tired of thinking about drinking blood.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
She calls it Wolfie.
I called mine Voldemort.
Did you?
Obviously, I made that name up myself.
Clearly.
He's a villain.
Yeah, by the way, as long as there's no dementors in the room. and then tell us about the kind of route that you took then, because you did go to AA for a while, didn't you? Did you try that?
I did. I went to 60 meetings in all.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so my dad was very big on AA, and that's how he had gotten his 20-odd years sober. So it was very much expected that I would do the same thing, so I went, and I really, really tried. And I have so much respect for AA, and it really got me off to a good start, and it taught me things that I still use today, like HALT. Has anyone heard of HALT?
Yeah, Hungry, Angry, Lonely, Tired.
Yeah. But I kept hitting my head against the higher power concept because I'm an atheist, and also I grew up in sectarian Northern Ireland, and I've got not great associations with sort of religious ways of thinking. And you can obviously use AA in a non-religious way. You can, you know, elect your higher power to be the universe or something like that. But there was other things that just I kept blocking my head against. I'm very much a questioner. I like to go away and do my own research and make my own mind up. And the things that I was attaching myself to had theories that were sort of counter to AA. So I found Holly's blog, Hip Sobriety.
Yeah,
I found Belle's Tired of Thinking About Drinking. And I'm really into neuroscience. So for me, as soon as I started, I was reading all these medical, really long papers about neural pathways and creating new ones. And that all attracted me much more.
But for you then, what did you do next then, as it were? When you said you did 60 meetings, did you then sort of get yourself connected, and what sort of helped you?
I would say I learnt lots and lots of things in AA that I took away, and then what I started doing was trawling social media and basically sliding into people's DMs and asking them to be my friend. That's how I built up my sober network, because that was the other thing. I didn't find my people in AA, and I was really hoping to do that, and just for whatever reason I didn't. So that was how I kind of assembled my people through Facebook groups and Instagram and all of that. And I went to lots and lots of sober meetups, you know, like the kind of thing, this.
Yeah, mindful drinking festival, So 10 years you've been sober.
Yes, 10
amazing?
Years.
How amazing is that?
That's brilliant. Believe it.
Amazing. So when did the idea of the book come to you then, and what was it that you really wanted to do with the book? Because yours was obviously one of the first, you know, wasn't it?
I think, well, I mean, then again, there was like Jack Trimpey before me.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
But
yours was the first really funky, fabulous one. Come
it was
on.
Still the first with a pretty cover. No, I think, to be fair, like, the, you know, Alan Carr's Easy Way
and
to
Jason
Stop Drinking, Jason Vale. So there was definitely lots of things that I sort of drew on strands and then added all my own stuff as well. And what was the question?
No, I just wondered what you were trying to do
with the book.
Yeah, what was your kind of thought process? What did you want to get across, given that you were... was one of the things you really wanted to get across, this joy?
Yeah, so that's exactly it. I kind of wanted to tell everyone about that, because what I'd been led to believe, and I believe it's still portrayed in the media, I can't think of any TV show that portrays a happy sober person.
No, exactly. It's always like, desperate, isn't it?
Please shout out if you can think of one.
Well, they're always completely at rock bottom.
Oh, they're
usually in secret.
They're usually detectives.
And then it's just absolute misery. I mean, I've seen so many things where, and even things like The Archers, when they do like a thread, you think, oh, maybe they'll be, I mean, not that I listen to it.
She clearly does.
I heard a bit. No, I don't actually.
It's not that episode.
I don't. Somebody just told me actually about this thread. And then I got all excited, because I thought, great. So if The Archers are covering someone who is choosing to be alcohol free, that's exciting.
Yeah.
But then, of course, it turns out it wasn't that at all. It was just, you know, somebody kind of, it was a hideous drinking a secret thing, and it all went bad.
Oh, no.
So that doesn't work, does it?
No, that doesn't work.
But anyway, as you're saying.
you heard it here, Janie listens to The Archers. No shame in that, Janie. But I was just sort of haunted by, everyone will remember Fun Bobby from Friends, who quits drinking and then he's no longer fun.
Yeah.
And nobody wants him around. And I was like, I don't want to be Fun Bobby.
Yeah.
I don't want to be like the one that nobody invites to the parties anymore.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect this kind of feeling. Well, they call it pink clouds, don't they?
Yes, that kind of the euphoria that you sometimes get.
Yeah, and I fully felt euphoric.
Yeah.
I remember grinning through a smear test, because I was like, check me out. I'm sorting
that
out.
That is too much information.
I know. Do you not know I'm
your
an oversharer?
Cervix.
I do overshare, Jenny. It's like my thing. And I even do hold back. I take 10% off the top, so you can't even imagine what the rest of the stories are.
See, how do you sell that to somebody? So, you know, I'm going to remember that for my coaching sessions, right? You just got to trust me, sweetheart.
Yeah,
you're
going to
be grinning at your smear test.
I think it was something about... Because I just went through this whole... I was like, I'm going to do all the adulting. I'm going to go and have my cheese checks.
I remember you talking about that. Yeah. That's just hilarious, the whole adulting thing.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed all of it, because I'd been dodging it for so long and feeling like a failed adult, age 33. And, I mean, I was living back with my parents, but I was doing things like going to the dentist, finally, for the first time in, you know, 4 years or whatever. There was just stuff like that I really wanted to tell people about. And then once I started digging into it, I was like, what we have been told is not true. Because if you actually talk to real life sober people, not Fun Bobby, then you will find that they are saying the same thing.
Nobody regrets it, do they?
No.
Nobody.
And then when you look into it, and I became obsessed with Googling sober celebrities and finding out what they'd said about it. And they were all saying, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it's the best decision I ever made. And I was like, why is this not common knowledge? About, why do people think? Because the reaction that I got from people when I told them, I mean, this was 10 years ago, bear in mind, it's not like that now.
Yeah, no, it was very different. It must have been harder for you in a way, because there wasn't the same level of kind of connection available and alcohol-free drinks and meetups and stuff back then.
Oh, there wasn't anything like that. If you were alcohol-free in a pub, you just basically had a sugary... J-Lo?
You met J-Lo.
J-Lo, please. Oh, like a sleep, baby. There wasn't any of this. None of this existed. So whenever I told people that I didn't drink, their reaction was always like, oh, what a shame.
Yeah.
Are you okay? Or like, I don't
know. Oh, did you have a problem?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Did something terrible happen? Or they just didn't want to talk to me anymore. And I was like, oh, that's great.
Yeah.
So that was how it was. So I had to go out and find my people and sort of start telling people, actually, this is fantastic, and I've never been happier in my life before. I remember giving some poor woman, she asked me, I was at this award ceremony, and she said, oh, that's terrible. Oh, you know, I'll keep my wine away from me. I was like, don't do that. It was the best decision of my life. I gave her this whole speech, and she looked very scared. And I was like, maybe I should stop doing this for people at parties and write it all down. Yeah.
So you obviously, I mean, obviously you're a writer, so it's very clear. I mean, your writing is, you are literally my favourite writer. You know that. You really are.
Ow.
And I read a lot of books.
And
what I really love about your writing is that you, obviously there's a lot of humour in there, and there's very much your voice, it's very clear. But in addition to that, you do a lot of research, so there's a lot of evidence-based stuff in there. So how did you go about, you know, kind of doing all of that research, and did that feel important to you to get that kind of, that kind of gravitas somehow?
Yeah, I mean, I truly don't think I would have sold the book, or it would have even got a book deal if I hadn't sort of widened it out. And that was very much what I was doing anyway as part of my recovery, because as I said, I'm more of a questioner. I want to go off and do my own investigation and find all the things and then collate them. But I was a journalist by trade, so that's how I had been trained to do it.
Yeah.
You know, you take your experience, and you write some funny anecdotes and soulful stories and all of that, but you also widen it out and bring it back to the reader. Mm. You don't just, you know, navel gaze kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, and I was fascinated by it. I was obsessed with it. So I just did a massive deep dive. I mean, I found the rough draft of it the other day. I was like, this must be 140,000 pages, and it's 140,000 words, and the resulting book is only 80,000 words.
Yeah.
And it's just drivel. It's just like bits posted that I posted on Facebook, and just random thoughts that I don't even really know what they mean. And I don't know how a book came out of it, but it did.
Yeah.
Just through a lot of hard work. But
and it did fantastically well, didn't it? I mean, you must have been so thrilled. Your publisher must have been delighted.
I think she was quite shocked.
Oh, really?
We didn't even have a book launch party. She was like, well, that's gonna...
Yeah. We can have a retrospective one.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, it was because I was very shy, still very, very introverted. Could never have done anything like this.
Really?
And I didn't want one. I was too scared.
Wow.
And then found myself on national TV. Later, I was like, oh my god, I'm terrified. If you ever see it on YouTube, I am so scared, and it's so obvious. I was on BBC Breakfast, but I lost the thread. So no, I don't think anyone expected it to do well, including me. I sort of thought, you know, it'll maybe sell 30 copies to my friends and family. I've managed to...
I know one of the things, and you mentioned friends and family, and one of the things that was really unique about your story and something that you shared was that you actually asked some friends to write a piece for the book about you.
Oh yeah,
oh,
I forgot that.
Man alive, that's brave.
It was.
That was brave. And they actually wrote how they, you know, kind of warts and all, like, well, actually, you weren't very nice then, but you're nice now, kind of thing. Oh, God, I wouldn't dare ask.
I don't know.
How were you brave enough to do that? It was really powerful, though, because, of course, when everyone's reading it, they're thinking, oh, God, I'm like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think okay, so there's this saying that says it's right from the scar, not the wound.
Yeah.
And I was 4 years sober by then, and I pretty much felt like a completely different human being.
Yeah.
And I was getting that feedback from almost everyone that I was completely different. So I think you need that distance. I would never advise somebody to start writing a memoir or anything like that when you're still in the very early stage.
I mean, agree.
Obviously start writing it, but do not publish it. I think you need that time under your belt, because also the publishing process is very tumultuous, and you get trolled and things like that. You know, I've had some horrible experiences where things have turned. And you need time to deal with that, and also, just that distance, and to know that you are a new human.
Yeah.
Like, you have changed massively.
Yeah. There's a real thing, isn't there, about this kind of new identity almost, and how you step into that new identity. It takes some time.
Yeah, I think it does. And people didn't really know what to make of me. They were like, you've been to a museum. You're drinking so much tea, and you're up at 6 a.m. I don't know who you are, and you've run 10 kilometres. I don't know what's going on. So they didn't quite know what to make of me, and it unsettled people at first. Actually, I got a really sweet message the other day from somebody who I used to drink a lot with, like a lot, one of my top drinking buddies, and she said something like, "Happy 10 years sober. It took a lot of adjusting our relationship when you quit drinking, but in retrospect, this is so much better."
Yeah.
And I think most people, even though there might be a rocky period where everything has to be recalibrated, because especially if your relationship has been founded in alcohol, you have to find a new relationship, basically.
Yeah. And there's no doubt, sometimes relationships do fall away. It's the way it is, isn't it? And that's really, really tough. And
it is.
I find myself saying to people quite a lot, you know, you have to focus on you and what it is you want and what it is you need. And those people that are going to come along with you will grow with you one way or the other.
Mm.
And the ones that aren't will naturally fall away.
Yeah.
And actually don't really have to do anything.
Yeah.
It just naturally falls away. And I know that's true for me. There are people who've just kind of naturally fallen away. And when I think back, they weren't actually real friends. We just used to drink each other under the table. It's not quite the same thing.
It's not. And sometimes those do take a few years to kind of ebb away. There's one in particular I'm thinking of, and it took maybe 6 years, where we both really sort of kept trying, and it just got to the point where it was like it wasn't going to work. And that is really sad, but it's right. It is right, because you do become a new person, I think.
Yeah.
And you have different morals and just a different way of being.
Yeah.
And so you're not going to match the people that you were hanging out with back then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Necessarily.
Yeah.
But then, having said that, my two best friends from school and university are the same.
Yeah.
And I don't think those relationships were necessarily founded in alcohol.
Yeah.
They, you know, that wasn't the glue that bonded us.
Yeah.
So I think that's the difference there.
Yeah, of course. And tell us a bit about your most recent book, Sunshine Warm Sober. Tell us a bit about that.
Okay.
Because again, I think I interviewed you for the podcast, and what was it that you really wanted to get across with that one?
Well, that was, because shockingly, all the lessons weren't contained in the first 4 years. So that was kind
there's
of
even more to do. Even
was,
more to do.
So much more. There was loads of things that I just only managed to touch upon in The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober, like setting boundaries.
Well, I was just about to say, that was the piece from that book that I really took away.
I
think
struggle.
We had a conversation on when you were on the podcast last, and I think I said to you then that when I was in my drinking days, I used to think that people who set boundaries were just really mean.
Oh, I thought
like,
they were horrible.
Selfish and mean. Like, what do you mean, no?
Yeah.
What do you mean you're not coming out? Bloody hell,
what
I've invited
tired?
You. What do you mean? Yeah, exactly. What do you mean you're trying to stop it?
I want you
and
to
I,
stay
yeah,
out.
I just thought those people were just like, so selfish.
Yeah.
Or boring, you know, one or the other.
Same.
I had no concept of what setting boundary meant.
And I would work on them and basically bully them until they did what I wanted.
But that book, you really went into detail about that.
Yeah, it's something that I do still struggle with, because the problem with boundaries is they keep you sane and they keep you safe, and they keep you from doing stuff that you don't want to do, which stops you from getting resentful, right? So it keeps you sober, ultimately.
Yeah.
But people don't like it.
Yeah, and you also want to be accommodating, of course, and a nice person. And, of course, lots of people who are drinking are people, or were drinking, are people pleasers.
Yeah.
So they end up drinking just because someone else wants them to drink.
Exactly. And if you're a people pleaser, then there's nothing worse than starting to people displease with the boundaries.
Yeah.
So that takes a lot of getting used to, but then it's the same thing. You just recalibrate, and eventually people get used to the fact that you now respect yourself, and you're not going to say yes if you can't or don't want to do something. But I think there is, I did go a little bit too far, I think, and now I'm kind of edging back a little bit, because I think I got to the point where I was like, no, not doing that either. And then I was like, actually, I like doing favors for people, and I like feeling like a community spirit, so I started sort of letting the walls down a bit. But I think almost it was necessary for it to be quite radical in the beginning, and then I could like gradually recede it and start letting things slip in that I don't necessarily want to do, but it would make me happy because it makes someone else happy. So yeah, but it was just everything that I wanted to write more about.
Yeah.
So it's more like advanced. It's for people who are at least, I would say, 2 or 3 years sober.
Yeah.
And it's more about the kind of all the other life. So if unexpected joy of being sober is like this bit, then it's the bigger concentric, what's that word? Concentric circles, and it's the bigger one.
Yeah.
Anyone
I know
what
you mean. You want me to do maths? Or something like that.
I don't know what you're talking about.
No, absolutely. And I mean, we can't also not mention your other fantastic book. So The Unexpected Joy of Being Single, which clearly you aren't anymore. But I love that book, even though I wasn't single. It was, I mean, really, that's a book about self-care, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, but also just being a raging love addict and thinking that if I found the right relationship, I was going to be happy ever after. And also I was going to, just be happy forever. Sorry. Hello, Simon.
It would be disastrous if it's all stopped recording. It's good.
Yeah, but it's funny because I looked back the other day at it and I was like, I still believe all of these things.
Yeah.
And I've been with my partner for 3.5 years now. We have a baby, we're engaged, but we have both said to each other, if ever we start making each other unhappy, we will end this, you know? I think what it is I think it's a life philosophy that you can carry through, because now that I know that I can be happy single, I'm not going to stay in the wrong relationship because I'm scared of the alternative.
Yeah.
And that's the point.
Yeah, and I think that's really powerful. So I think anyone who has those tendencies towards codependency would kind of read that and realise, oh, okay, because you talk, you really explain how it feels to actually, you need to really know yourself. That's important.
Yeah, I think so. And I could only, because I was the kind of person that would merge to whoever I was with. If they were really into political dramas and karaoke, I would do that too. So I was just like, okay, we'll
that
do
could
that.
Be dangerous.
But I thought of myself as a strong-minded, fiercely independent person, but I wasn't. I was just sort of, and my friends would make gentle suggestions that maybe I didn't just change according to whoever I was dating, and I just obviously batted that off. So now I have much more self-knowledge, and it's totally different the way I have relationships now, just because of that year of dating.
And then, of course, The Unexpected Joy of the Ordinary.
Yeah.
Oh God, I think it's one of my absolute favourite books. Who's in the sober club here? Who has ever done a Zoom with me? Practically every session we ever do, I end up going, oh, and then of course I reckon I pick it off my shelf, and it's always right there. Aww. Because we're always talking about the little things that make the difference.
Yeah.
So when you get into a funk, when you start to feel a bit fed up, when the cravings come in, when whatever, the on and on and on, actually you've got to look to the little things, the little bright spots. It isn't all the spa days and the fantastic parties. You know, actually life goes on and we have to find that joy of the ordinary.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that book because before, when I was drinking, I had no concept of what that might even be.
Yeah.
I mean, really, I had no idea. Yeah. And I've often made jokes about the fact that I had a couple of friends. I had one friend who had always been a non-drinker, just always been teetotal. And she would kind of like, you know, we'd meet and she would go, oh, let's go to that tea place. And, oh, this, look at this adorable little cup and I'm going to have some green tea. And I'd be like,
fill it with
have
vodka.
You gone mad? Get me the bloody glass of wine and yeah. stop wanging on about a teacup.
Yeah.
Seriously. So, and now I completely realise she was the lucky one.
Yeah.
I was the one. I couldn't see beyond anything other than, oh, get me a drink.
Yeah, absolutely.
But now I totally get that. And I loved your book because you gave us all these fantastic ideas and actual lists.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Things we could do.
About the list. Yeah, that's true.
Can you recite any of your lists? I should have prepped you.
Oh, God, I really wish I could. But do you know
what? One is getting a bit of paper and screwing it up and seeing if you can hit the bin.
I still do
see,
that.
It's not the big stuff.
I
it's
still
not
love
the big
doing
stuff.
That. I really
pressing
like
down a cafetiere.
Yeah. That's pure joy.
Yeah, isn't
but,
it?
Yeah. But it's funny that you should mention that because when I've had my daughter, I stopped doing my nightly gratitude list because that is the one thing that has like followed me through the whole 10 years of sobriety, the one tool, apart from maybe like exercise and things like that, but it's the one thing that I would say has helped my mental health the most.
Yeah.
Which is because I am, I'm a gloomy sort of person. Like, I've got a negatively biased brain. I like to look for the faults in things. I like to catastrophize and like, well, what if this would happen? What if a, you know, massive HGV smashes through this wall and kills us all? And like, that's not a fun way to live. But it's just how my brain does it. And it's how most people's brains behave. Most of us have negatively biased brains, and that helps just on the savannah when we needed to run from lion. We had to be like hypervigilant to danger and, you know, spot any, but that's not useful at Euston Station.
Yeah, exactly. There's no tigers in fact.
Yeah, there's no tigers.
Not a single tiger.
Your brain is still looking for all the potential threats. And so that's something, when I had my daughter, I stopped doing it. I was like, I'm so tired, I can't be bothered to write a list about throwing paper and spin. And I really noticed that I started suffering mentally for it. And so I now do it every night again. And it's just, I feel weird if I go to sleep and I haven't done it. And sometimes I write pages and pages and pages. And it's just total nonsense. Like, I'd never want anyone to see it. It's just complete stream of consciousness, nothing crafted about it. You know, I'm not looking for good words. I'm just like, today was nice.
Yeah. Well, it's just, it's looking for those little bright spots, isn't it?
Exactly.
And I think certainly when people are, you know, in the early weeks of stopping drinking, everything just feels, you don't know who you are, everything feels weird. And if you can just notice tiny things.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember, you know, really tiny things like noticing that I didn't feel dizzy if I washed my hair.
Yeah.
That was quite nice.
Oh.
You know, which wouldn't mean anything to anybody else. But to me, the fact that I was able to notice it was good because it helps to kind of populate that side of the brain that can fill up with some positive associations rather than just, you know, when everything goes bad, you immediately go to the other side of the brain. Oh, I think I'll reach for a drink.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I want to feel not dizzy.
Yeah.
So you're right. It's that gratitude is everything really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I would even go so far as to say that that is what I was doing when I wrote the book. I was just recording in my way of recording. I like to write, and, you know, other people take photos or do voice notes or whatever they do, they paint, but that's how I locked it down.
Yeah.
And I think that's what made it stick.
Yeah.
Just noticing all the beautiful things about it. And then that sort of bled out in those concentric circles. And I started
which we don't
doing
have a word
it
for.
About all my life. I think it's micro and macro. I think that's what I'm looking for. But I started doing it in everything, and I just found that I became a lot happier. You've got nothing to lose.
No, exactly.
But your disenchantment.
You get more of what you focus on, right?
Yeah,
so if
absolutely.
We focus on the good stuff.
But I still, you know, I'm still a bit of a grumpy sod.
Yeah.
I still get irritated
by things.
But
that's normal, isn't it? That's okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's fine.
I think it really comes back down to accepting that, you know, all of life is not necessarily, you know, rainbows and bunnies just because you're sober. There's still going to be stuff happens. But it's how you are able to kind of bring yourself back to balance that matters.
Absolutely. And I don't think there's anything wrong ever with noticing all the things that are right. It doesn't mean that you have to feel guilty if you have a bad day. Like, that's not what it's about. You can still have all the dark moods and all the negative thoughts, but if you are actively noticing and looking for the good things as well, then you just tip yourself over into that direction, and it really, really helps.
Yeah. And how absolutely fantastic that from the off you're going to be fully present as a parent.
I know.
I can't tell you how jealous I am. You know, when I look back, that's my only regret, is that I didn't do this sooner. And I wasn't fully present. And it's, oh my God, you know, maybe I'll get some grandchildren one day and I can try again. But for you, that is just, I mean, what a gift, and how you must really feel keenly that because it's not always like that. You know, you're well aware of the mummy wine culture that many of us here will have been part of, right? Probably like me, you say, oh my God, that was me. And literally from the second you give birth, everyone's just throwing, you know, champagne down you. I remember that some kind of health visitor forcing Guinness down my neck for breast milk.
Oh my God.
I remember thinking, you know, so that you've got more breast milk. And I remember thinking, fantastic, I don't even like Guinness, so I'm sure the wine will be okay. You know, for God's sake. What are they thinking? You know, and God, when I think back, it's, I could have, you know, it would have been so much better if I'd been fully present. It's very exciting for you. It's wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what I'm eventually going to tell her about alcohol. And I've just realised, because when I wrote all my books, I wasn't going to have a child. I didn't want a baby.
Yeah.
And then just something aged 39, 40, like, flipped.
Yeah.
I think it was related to finally buying my own place and sort of feeling financially secure. And something just turned on. But now I've written all these books where I talk about all the worst things I've ever done. They're going to be accessible.
Oh, don't worry, she'll enjoy them when she's older.
I'm just really hoping they're out.
My rock and roll
then.
Mother.
I'm going to have to buy all the copies. If anyone has a copy, send
Van
it to
Morrison
me.
Van Morrison did that once, didn't he? An autobiography, a biography came out about Van Morrison that he absolutely hated, so he just ordered every single copy to give
away. Oh my God.
Which was fantastic for the writer. Although I'm not sure he got a second book deal, but certainly got some money from that one. Yeah. So what's next for you?
Oh, so I've written a novel.
So exciting. Can I be your... is it done and dusted?
Yeah, it's done.
Oh, I can't even pre... Can I not even be a pre-reader then?
You can have a proof in January.
Perfect, thank you.
And it comes out...
How exciting.
I'm really excited. I wrote it when I was pregnant. It's kind of... I can't say too much because the announcement hasn't been made, but it's called Versions of a Girl. It's going to be published in July by Headline.
Amazing.
And the best way of summing it up, it's kind of like Sliding Doors meets Atonement.
I like it already.
It's got a split reality. And when I wrote it, I was pregnant and I was obsessed with the whole interplay between nature and nurture and how you're raised propels you in a direction and how those North Star character traits that are always going to come out and how you can push in the other way if you need to. And it kind of came out in this kind of dual storyline, which is about a girl, one version of her is raised by her father, and one girl version of her is raised by her mother in very different circumstances, and looking at how she develops. And I'm really pleased with it. The first draft was rubbish.
Was it?
It was so bad. But it was my first go.
So, it's completely different, isn't it, writing a novel? Completely different.
It couldn't be more different. It's much harder, I think.
Yeah.
And I thought it was going to be easy. I thought it was going to be a doddle. Because I was like, just make stuff up.
Yeah.
What can be hard about that? And then I actually realised it wasn't very good. And I was like, okay, I need to really study this. So I went away and read everything I could about writing. Read tons and tons of great books and sort of analysed it, because I'm a student, my motto is my cup is never full, so I'm always trying to learn new things about everything, I don't believe in ever stopping learning.
Yeah,
and so actually now I love it, finally,
so
having
exciting.
Rewritten it
completely from scratch. I can't wait to read it, I absolutely can't. So it, as and when it's a huge success, which I'm sure it will be, then you're going to have to write the second difficult novel. That's going to be even harder, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or are you already onto it?
I think I know what it's going to be.
Okay.
But I can't say.
No, you can't say. And of course, we must ask: is there a sober or a drunk character in there? Are we allowed to know that?
Oh, there's addiction.
I mean, they always say that your first novel is very much based on yourself.
Well, I couldn't possibly comment.
You couldn't possibly comment.
The main character is called Catherine. No. I've already written that story. I do think that it's funny. Because I do think there is something very autobiographical about fiction in a way that it's almost like I was talking earlier about being an oversharer, but I've taken 10% off the top.
Yeah.
My first reader for Unexpected Joy of Being Sober told me to do that. She said, you know, I think it's amazing that you're telling the truth now and you're saying all these raw things, but you don't have to share absolutely everything. You can take 10% off the top, and I did, and I'm so glad that she told me to do that, because those stories are basically in the novel. No.
Everything gets repurposed.
Yeah,
they become a very green writer, don't you? Repurpose everything.
They're very disguised. Everything just sort of gets morphed, and you know, you take the characters are like amalgamations of people, you know. I thought that was thunder. No, it's not. Okay, we're all right.
Good. Amazing. Well, look, I can't believe where the time has gone. And I'm so grateful to you for joining us. It's just absolutely brilliant to catch up.
Oh,
and so
you.
Exciting to hear all of your amazing news. And we can't wait for the novel. And I'm going to have to let you go back to your baby.
Yeah.
There's bound to be people who are going to be clamouring for a picture. So
I can stick around for a bit.
All right, brilliant. Yeah. So don't all bombard at once.
Oh, I want to swivel it back to you, though.
Okay. Oh, dear.
Janie.
That's scary.
I want to thank Janie because she is one of the absolute heroes of Soberland, which we're now going to, I'm just going to call it that, Soberland. And she put so much time and effort and magic into it, and I just think you're amazing.
Oh, thank you so much. So, big thank you to Catherine Gray. We should just give a mention to this fabulous space at Club Soda, where we're surrounded by just millions of incredible alcohol-free drinks. Which 10 years ago, you'd have been lucky if you'd got some kind of dodgy beer, right? And the wine would have tasted like vinegar. Seriously.
J-Lo.
You'd be lucky if you got J-Lo, 10 years ago. So we're very grateful to be in this fabulous space. And thank you. Thank you so much for coming. Catherine.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you so much, Catherine. I cannot wait for your novel. I just can't wait. I just know it's going to be such a massive hit, right? We'll obviously get Catherine back on the podcast if she'll come when the novel is out. And thanks again to everyone who came to that event. Thanks to everyone who cheered us on. And to those of you who got tickets and you couldn't make it, I really hope you enjoyed the interview and were there with us kind of in spirit, but not an alcoholic spirit. And come along to the next one. We'll definitely put something else on, because that the connection piece is just absolutely magical. So don't forget, if you do want to feel connected, join us in the Sober Club. It makes so much difference to be focusing on your well-being, on your self-care, and everything else that we offer. It really is the holistic picture. So check it out if you haven't already, thesoberclub.com. It's a small monthly fee. It's lots of value. It really is. For anyone who's going to be alone at Christmas, we've got a meetup on Christmas Eve. So a kind of a drop in. So if anyone is going to be at a loose end on Christmas Eve, you'd be very welcome to join us. And then early in January, there'll be a setting your intentions for the new year event. So drop me a message if that's something you'll be interested in. We'll open that out to everyone, not just Sober Club members. Come and join us if you can. We also did a session on bossing your Christmas sober. So that's in our member portal as well, with some great tips for the Christmas prep. If that is you, by the way, if this is going to be your first sober Christmas, absolutely do your prep. Don't just wing it. Do your prep. Lots and lots of tips, lots of advice for you. So drop me a message if you're just starting out on this journey. Tell someone, okay? It can be me. Tell someone, but don't just hole up and try and do it on your own. It really is brilliant to feel connected. And thank you again to Janet Hadley, soberbusinessnetwork.co.uk. If you have a sober business and you want to get connected, and Janet is offering that free 30-day trial using the code Janey30. That's capital letters JANEY30 at the checkout there for soberbusinessnetwork.co.uk. So I'll see you same time next week. I'd completely forgotten how close we're getting to Christmas. So I'll make sure I do some more Christmassy stuff for you. But as I say, if it is your first sober Christmas and you're starting to feel a little bit nervous about it, reach out. There's definitely lots of tips and lots of stuff there for you. Check out thesoberclub.com, the blog post. There's a blog post there with some great ideas for how you can prep towards Christmas, including that fantastic recipe for alcohol-free mulled wine, which is an absolute winner. I'll see you same time next week. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.